Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. The University of Lethbridge is launching the Prentice Institute for Global Population and Economics, thanks to an $8 million endowment from a Calmar family that has made its mark in the hog and cattle business. And the master's theses of two recent graduates in wildlife ecology look at the effect of industrial development on grizzly bears and marten. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. Dignitaries from the University of Lethbridge came north to Edmonton last week to announce the establishment of a new institute that will focus on global population and economy. The $8 million endowment is the largest in the history of the University of Lethbridge. It was a gift from John Prentice, a prominent member of the agribusiness community near Calmar. Dr. Bill Cade is the president of the University of Lethbridge.
The institute is named the Prentice Institute for Global Population and Economy. It has come from the Prentice family. John and Connie Prentice are the parents, as well as from their kids, Heather, Maureen, and Fergus, and their granddaughter, Coco. And John is a very prominent and very successful Albertan who worked with Connie to establish their business over many years and much hard work. And so they are continuing to leave their mark on this province through establishing this institute today.
What will the institute do?
The institute itself will be devoted to studying some very important trends in the social sciences, specifically the demographic issues facing the world, the economic issues facing the world, and the water crisis that is facing the world too. It is meant to truly be a global focus for the Prentice Institute.
Now, how are you actually going to build this institute?
Well, this is about people, and the focus of the institute will be to bring some very high caliber, some very successful academics to our campus through the endowed chairs. There will be chairs in demography and economics and in water policy. What that does is it attracts other people. It attracts other faculty. It attracts students. It attracts scientists and social scientists and faculty from the humanities from all over the world. And so we see this is the core of what this institute will accomplish. It will be overseen by a board of directors that will involve the Prentice family as well as appointees from the university. And, of course, it will be part of the University of Lethbridge and thus operate under the Board of Governors of the university. It is a really exciting development. I'd have to say it's the most exciting thing I've ever been involved in many years of university work.
Well, congratulations and thank you very much, Bill.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to see you here. I appreciate your interest, as always.
That was Dr. Bill Cade, president of the University of Lethbridge. Also on hand for the announcement was Dr. Seamus O'Shea, provost at the University of Lethbridge.
It's a visionary gift, a transformational gift. It's a wonderful opportunity for the university to work on a very significant set of challenges in the area of the social sciences and humanities, and I think it will make a tremendous difference to the university.
What are you actually going to do with this institute?
Well, we're going to go out and hire some really first-rate researchers to work on issues related to demographics and economics. Because of changes in life expectancy and dropping birth rates, the population of the developed world is getting older relatively quickly. On the other hand, in the underdeveloped world, there's still a very large young population. So that's setting up a very difficult tension for the world. There are issues about distribution of wealth and economic challenges that need to be resolved for the long-term well-being of the human population. So we're going to work on those issues and try to understand how this will affect the well-being of people over the next two or three generations.
When do you think we'll actually see something starting?
Well, we're going to start looking almost immediately. We're going to go out trying to identify some excellent candidates to hire and put together a business plan for the way that we're going to do the research, but we'll be getting rolling almost immediately.
What was it like for you getting that phone call saying that someone was interested in giving you some money? Because my understanding is you didn't go out looking for it.
No. John actually phoned me. We began to talk about the kind of things that we could do, and we were well into the conversation before I had any idea what kind of a donation he was talking about. And of course, I was completely taken by surprise. It was just far beyond anything we've had before, and it was just amazing. No other word for it.
What are your thoughts about the person, John Prentice?
He's the kind of person I wish I'd known for years. A very original thinker, a very clear thinker, energetic man, visionary, quite a remarkable individual.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Seamus O'Shea, Provost of the University of Lethbridge. Because of ill health, the donors John and Connie Prentice could not attend the news conference to announce the new Prentice Institute for Global Population and Economy, but their children were there. Son Fergus presented the check for $8 million, and daughter Heather passed on the best wishes of her parents. Heather Prentice is the principal at Temple School in Edmonton.
Well, my dad was diagnosed with esophageal cancer at the end of May, and it had metastasized to the stomach and other organs in the body, so he knew he didn't have long to live. And he's had this in his mind as something he's wanted to do for a long time, and so just really the timing was pushed up, and we got in touch with Seamus O'Shea at the University of Lethbridge, and he was fantastic at coming and explaining the philosophy of the University of Lethbridge, and we saw a really good fit between our family beliefs and the University of Lethbridge being an open market-based approach to education.
What has been your father's interest in global population?
Well, he thinks that the Western world is not having enough children. And so he's been wanting grandchildren for about the last 20 years, and now he has two grandchildren and hopefully more coming along as well. He sees the Western world population declining, and other countries, India, Iran, Yemen, some of the African countries, as really leading the world in terms of fertility. And over time, this will contribute to a shift in the demographics of the world. I mean, decrease in Western population, rise in populations in other places, and this will have an impact on our history as people move around and acquire power and economic power.
What was it like for you having to put all of this together?
Well, it's been stressful. You know, being a school principal and juggling this with helping my family, because it's been a very difficult time for our family, it's been difficult. You're lucky I didn't weep today when I was trying to give my speech. I had a backup ready, because it's a sad time, but it's also a very exciting time, because we see that my dad is leaving a legacy that will benefit us as a country, as a University of Lethbridge, as a family, and so we're very excited about that, and that overshadows the sadness today.
$8 million is a lot of money. What is it that your family has done in their business in order to be so successful? What has been the focus of your company?
It's agriculture. I grew up on a hog farm, and my dad was active as a hog farmer until 1987, and then he went into partnership with a fellow who actually had worked on our farm earlier, Simon Goodwin from Yorkshire in England, and became kind of like a silent partner, did the finance, the tax advice, and got into feeding cattle. So, you know, he's made his money and made an impact in the industry in agriculture.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was Heather Prentice, principal at Tempo School and eldest daughter of benefactor John Prentice of Calmar. I also spoke with Dr. Bill Cade and Dr. Seamus O'Shea. Alberta's grizzly bear population is at risk from industrial development, and one of the people studying what's happening to our bears is Carrie Raver. Carrie conducted her master's research under the supervision of Dr. Mark Boyce. He holds the Alberta Conservation Association Chair in Fish and Wildlife at the University of Alberta. Carrie tried to find out why grizzly bears in the foothills are attracted to areas with roads, when they seem to avoid roads in other regions of Alberta.
So roads are a possible attractant because the road itself has a ditch associated with it. So this ditch has herbaceous vegetation like dandelions and clover, and these are really good bear foods. So the bears might actually be attracted to the road. Roads are also built in low elevation valleys. So these areas tend to green up sooner in the spring, and so when the higher elevations are frozen, bears might be attracted to the low elevation valleys. So they might not be using the roads per se, but they might be attracted to the valleys instead.
What kinds of things did you find out then? Were things different than what you had originally thought?
They were actually very similar to what I had originally thought. We didn't think that roads themselves would be much of an attractant, although for some bears, like habituated females, they might tend to use roads more, and we were finding that bears with cubs were a little bit closer to roads. In terms of the low elevation valleys, grizzly bears, the females with cubs and subadults tended to use all low elevation valleys, but males tended to use the roaded low elevation valleys more.
Why is that, the difference between male and female?
Well, that was one thing that I was trying to figure out. And so why would the males be closer to the roaded valleys and females be using the non-roaded valleys? And there was another component to this, is that roads are often associated with cut blocks as well. And cut blocks can be really good food sources for grizzly bears. So I was thinking maybe they weren't attracted to the roads, but instead to the associated cut block. And so I did some modeling and looked at grizzly bear movements around roads and grizzly bear movements around cut blocks. And I found that both the roads and the cut blocks predicted grizzly bear movement equally well. So this seems to indicate, because there's a lot of research on why grizzly bears would use cut blocks, particularly in forests with a history of fire suppression. As the forest gets older, the canopy tends to close up, the openings tend to close up, and there's not a lot of foods available on the forest floor for bears to eat. So instead, they use these cut blocks in order to gain access to this food. There's also a lot of studies on why grizzly bears would avoid roads, mainly because they die there. So it seems to indicate that grizzly bears are actually in these roaded areas for the cut blocks and not for the roads.
What's the danger then for the bears when they're around the roads?
The main problem is human mortality. So there has been another study that went on in the Banff area, and they found that 90% of grizzly bear mortalities are caused by humans. And of these mortalities that they actually knew the location of, all of them occurred within 500 meters of a road or 200 meters of a trail. So these bear mortalities are occurring near these roaded areas. So by placing a road in high-quality grizzly bear habitat, we might actually be leading them to their death. So they're attracted to these areas because there's a lot of food there, but they end up dying there, so it's a real problem.
Well, what are they dying from? Is it vehicle accidents or hunting or poaching?
Well, the hunting season was closed this year, so that's very good. But for the previous years, hunting was the highest mortality. But next to that was poaching. And then there was management action. So grizzly bears have become habituated and start getting into people's garbage and stuff like that. They are put down or moved to a different area. There's also vehicle collisions, but they're very, very small. It's not a big issue.
So the hunting, since it's so close to the road, are people shooting from their vehicles, or it just happens that it's convenient for both people and bears?
Well, this was sort of an interesting study. So the hunters tend to be a little bit further away from roads. They tend to walk in more and are actually actively hunting the bear. They're not just shooting them off the road from their car. But poaching tends to be right on the road.
How is it that you actually track these bears?
They have GPS radio collars on them, so they can upload. So every 4 hours, they would locate the satellites in the sky, and then it would get a fix on where they're actually located, and we would get a location every 4 hours, so we could see how they're actually moving across the landscape at really fine scales.
The research that you've done and the findings that you've got, what is the significance of this? How is this going to fit into the bigger picture of how we should be dealing with grizzly bears and their conservation?
This study I find is really interesting. One, we're doing this DNA census. Well, the Foothills Model Forest is doing a DNA census, and they're finding that grizzly bear numbers are much lower than we had actually anticipated, and that's one of the reasons why the hunt was actually closed. And The Foothills Model Forest has also compared grizzly bear health in the parks to grizzly bear health in the foothills. And bears in the foothills are actually much healthier. They reproduce at a younger age, and they're much less stressed because they have a lot of foods. But they also tend to die really soon. So since 1999, the study has been going on, and they haven't captured any females over 10 years old in the foothills, whereas in the parks, they have females that are in their 20s. And so mortality is a big issue in the foothills. And so even though bears are doing really well, they have a lot of food, so they're not very stressed, they're producing lots of young, they're also dying really early. So it's a real problem. And so what we need to do is try to sort of mitigate these mortality issues to increase bear populations in the foothills.
When you wrote up your analysis and your master's thesis, did you make any recommendations?
Yes. So because we're looking at an attractive sink, so an area that grizzly bears are attracted to, but they end up dying there, there's two things that we can do to manage this population. First, we can reduce the attractants around roads, and second, we can reduce the mortality. So to reduce the attractants, first we need to stop planting clover in ditches. Clover is a really high-quality food source for bears, and so by having this clover in the ditch, bears are often attracted to the roads. Also, we tend to have really wide ditches near roads, and we should actually probably make the ditches more narrow. And this might sound counterintuitive because we like to have wide ditches so that we can see an animal up ahead so we can slow down so we don't hit it. But by having these wide ditches, the animals are actually attracted to the area, and we might actually be increasing the number of collisions or the number of encounters between humans and bears. The second set of options is to reduce the mortality risk around roads. And to do that, first, because grizzly bears might be attracted to the cut blocks and not the road, we should probably put up a beauty strip, so put forests in between the road and the cut block, so that people who are driving along the road can't see into the cut block, and grizzly bears are more secure in these areas when they are using them. And also, of course, we need to increase access management, so just reduce the number of roads that are on the landscape.
Are there any other management practices that you would recommend?
Instead of just completely decommissioning roads, which is very controversial, we can also put gates on the roads and just close them seasonally. So one part of my study, I found that grizzly bears tend to eat herbaceous vegetation and ungulates in the spring, and then their diet switches to eating berries in the fall. And I found that herbaceous vegetation is more abundant near roads, and berries aren't very abundant near roads. So as a result, with the grizzly bear data, we were actually seeing that grizzly bears were moving close to roads in the spring when they were eating herbaceous vegetation, and they were moving away from roads in the fall when they were eating berries. So as a result of this, we can close the roads in the spring when bears are most likely to be around roads, and then we can open those gates in the fall when bears aren't necessarily going to be close to roads.
So that would go hand in hand then with not planting clover in the ditches, because that's what would green up in the spring, right?
Yes, exactly.
Well, it sounds like you've done a lot of really valuable research. Thank you very much, Carrie.
Thank you for having me.
That was Carrie Raver, a recent master's graduate in wildlife ecology at the University of Alberta. Carrie studied under Dr. Mark Boyce, who holds the Alberta Conservation Association Chair in Fish and Wildlife. Another graduate from the Boyce Lab in Fish and Wildlife Conservation at the University of Alberta is Chevenelle Mullen. Chevenelle came to Alberta from Maine, where she used to hunt on a trap line. Chevenelle's master's research looked at a small fur-bearing animal called the marten. She was interested in the impact of industrial development on marten habitat and their population trends.
Well, these guys are in the weasel family, so they look like a ferret. They're a little bit larger than a ferret, actually. And they've got long, luxurious, beautiful fur, which is why they're a prized fur bear. And they eat mostly small mammals. One of their favorite is the red-backed vole. And they live in mature, structurally complex forests. So they like lots of snags and brush piles. They can get into with their long, skinny body, and they can catch mice.
What's been your interest in the marten?
Well, my interest is actually to use harvest records to actually connect and relate to actually maybe population trends. So we use harvest data as a proxy for population data that's already being freely collected by trappers today.
How would you actually use that?
Well, what's really interesting with trapping data is it's a fairly long-term data set. And most researchers, you know, they do a master's study, maybe it's 2 years long. If you're lucky, you've got a PhD study with 5 years. And the realm of ecology, that's not a long time to really look at any sort of trend data. Whereas with trapping data, we've got Hudson's Bay records that go back to the, like, you know, 1600s. Kathy Shire's work in Mark Boyce's lab is actually looking at some of those older records to look at cycles and mink muskrat harvest data, which is really interesting. So my data set actually consisted of 30 years of harvest data for marten in the foothills of Alberta.
And what have you found out from that data?
So I had two components of my study. The first is a social component. So I was looking at what factors affect trapper behavior. And what we found were some really interesting results as far as trappers being affected by industrial disturbance, which we know is increasing in Alberta, and we've got lots of research ongoing right now to study, you know, the effects of that on sensitive wildlife species. And what we found is that not only in our social component, but as well as the biological influence, when we looked at the harvest data, trappers caught fewer marten areas that were more heavily disturbed, suggesting that there are certain influences of disturbance on the landscape for sensitive wildlife like marten.
And what was the other component?
So the two components were that social influence of trapper behavior effects, and not only disturbance, but pelt prices or health factors or other things that would affect trappers' ability to get out on the trap line. That second effect was the biological influence, and so that was the harvest data set that I actually used variables like the amount of mature coniferous forest cover, the amount of area that was cut, or the amount of access to actually model harvest patterns.
So are marten populations in danger in Alberta at this time?
Marten are doing quite well in Alberta. What's interesting is throughout our 30-year study, we actually saw an increase in harvests, which is a little contrary to what you might think. We think, well, we've got a lot of industrial disturbance on the landscape. Maybe we've seen a decline in harvests. Also, we know pelt prices and market influences have certainly declined in the past 30 years. So we found an increase in harvests, and we think that's because of increased access, which allows trappers to get into areas, all areas of their trap line, to exploit, to set maybe more traps or to spread the same number of traps around, which means they can catch more animals. And it may be a product that, as effects of forest maturation due to fire suppression, that we've actually had a true increase in the amount of good quality habitat out there, this mature conifer habitat, with increasing marten populations. So marten are doing quite well right now.
Now, I understand that when you were back in Maine before you came to Alberta to do this study, you actually did some trapping yourself.
I did, and I think having a recreational as well as research trapping background is important, I think, to sort of kind of figure out what is driving harvest patterns. And we know a lot of the biology of these organisms. We suspect that marten are very sensitive to habitat loss, but there's a lot of other social influences that are driving the number of animals being trapped as well. So it's important, I think, to have a background for the modeling process.
It's actually quite amazing that trapping still goes on in Alberta and that it's an important part of some people's lives. Why do you think that we still continue with the trapping?
I think that's a really important question. Despite all the negative things for trapping, you know, we've had in the States, we've had multiple ballot initiatives to ban trapping altogether. We've had decrease in pelt prices, so it's not really cost effective. You're not making any money today to trap. So that means there has to be kind of a deeper incentive to carry out this traditional activity. And overwhelmingly, that's what I got from these surveys that I did with trappers, was that there was this deeper kind of emotional sense to kind of a traditional way of life. The lifestyle associated with trapping was why people carried out to continue to trap, even if they lost money doing it. And if you think about it, it's a recreation. The things that people describe why they enjoy trapping may be the reasons that a birder might describe why they like to go birding, or why you might like to go outside and, you know, go canoeing. So the broad things, what we enjoy about recreational activities outside, may be pretty similar.
Well, now that you've actually finished your research on this and you've defended your master's thesis, What are the conclusions that you came to?
Well, so one of the conclusions we found is that there's definitely not a economic incentive for trapping today, that there's definitely a deeper incentives such as the lifestyle associated with trapping animals and having a cabin and all of those things. Something else we found from our modeling of harvest records was that trappers were less active on more developed trap lines. As well, they caught fewer marten on more developed trap lines. And that the amount of this closed conifer or mature coniferous forest was very important predictor for the number of marten being taken, which is what we would suspect. Everything points to habitat is important for marten. And we actually found an interesting threshold point where when less than a third of the trap line was composed of this mature coniferous forest, trappers caught few animals. So it maybe suggests that we need to maintain a certain amount of habitat on registered trap lines to maintain marten and therefore trapping of marten.
Well, that leads into my next question then as to, now that you have these conclusions, what does that mean for future management of marten?
Well, so definitely our research so shows that you can use long-term area-specific harvest data to model or make relations to actual population trends. And we are working on our manuscripts right now to show our information to the world, I guess you can say. And we have made management recommendations for managers to continue monitoring habitat and also using trapping records in a similar fashion that we've used with GIS data to monitor where we expect marten trends to go in the future, given industrial disturbance on the landscape.
What are those trends?
Well, we've definitely... I mean, that wasn't a key focus for my research necessarily, but quantifying landscape change was something that was a part of my research. And the rates of industrial disturbance are quite high right now. Suggesting that, you know, given the current habitat loss, that it's not looking good for sensitive forested species like marten on the landscape, and that we need to do something now in land use planning to put something in place before the detrimental effects are caused. So,
well, thank you very much, Chevanel.
Thanks for having me, Cheryl.
That was Chevanel Mullen, a recent master's graduate from biological sciences at the University of Alberta. She studied under Dr. Mark Boyce, who holds the Alberta Conservation Association Chair in Fish and Wildlife. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our e-newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the University of Lethbridge, Alberta Conservation Association, Alberta Research Council, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, Calgary Technologies, Inc., Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, Alberta Innovation and Science, Alberta Gaming Research Institute, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, Alberta Ingenuity, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, and the NSERC Industrial Chair in Integrated Landscape Management. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.